Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Fiction. I'm G.P. Gottlieb, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Tony Romano about his new book, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins, published in December of 2017 by Allium Press, a local Chicago press. The book imagines what it might have been like for one of the survivors of a tragic fire that took place in a Catholic school in the Humboldt Park neighborhood of Chicago on December 1st, 1958. After the fire broke out, just before the end of the day at Our Lady of the Angels School, it just swept through the old wooden building. 92 children and 3 nuns were killed, and the fire is still considered to be one of Chicago's most horrendous tragedies. The fire began in a basement trash bin and went unnoticed for a critical amount of time because smoke detectors had not yet become commercially available. In his book, author Tony Romano imagines 20-year-old Anthony Lazzaro, who along with his best friend Marianne, survives the fire. Marianne was in the same class as Anthony's sister Ellie, who didn't make it out of the school in time. The story opens with Anthony suffering from an unnamed mental illness, deliberately breaking his own leg. It had started to feel foreign to his body. Lipschultz, the retired cop who lives next door, thinks Anthony may have set the fire and that his strange behavior is just another sign of his guilt. Since the fire, Anthony's family has fallen apart. His father disappears, his mother takes a faraway job, and Anthony lives with his grandmother. He also lives with the ghost of his beloved sister. In this beautifully written, sensitive novel, Tony Romano considers trauma and how it can be overcome through time and the love of family and community. And now I'd like to say hello to Tony Romano, author of When the World Was Young and If You Eat, You Never Die, and the book we're going to be talking about today, Where My Body Ends and the World Begins. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Galit.
How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. So let's start out by, if you wouldn't mind, telling us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? Where'd you go to school? And what do you do when you're not writing?
Okay. I was born in Italy and came here when I was a year old, which isn't all that remarkable, except that when we came here, my father was 37 years old. He didn't know a word of English, probably the most timid guy you'd ever meet, weighed about 100 pounds when he arrived here until my mom fattened him up a bit. So I've lived with this wonder of what if we hadn't come here? What would I be doing now? Who would I be? And for me, this is the perfect place to be for a writer, because people who are always certain don't need to write anything down. But I've lived with this uncertainty my whole life. So anyway, we moved to Chicago to the kind of neighborhood described in the book, blue collar, hardworking, not looking to get rich, just enough to provide for their families. And I went to a Catholic school three or four doors down from the school so we can come home for lunch every day, because that was the most important thing, not English or history or catechism, but the minestrone soup and the pasta fazzule. And so I stayed in Chicago, went to DePaul, and I taught high school English and psychology for many, many years. So that's it.
And when did you start writing and publishing?
Well, probably started seriously when I was at Northeastern for a master's degree, and I found out that I didn't need to write a thesis if I chose to write short stories instead, my own short stories. So that's what I did. I took the same classes over there, the same creative writing classes over and over again until I had a collection that became If You Eat, You Never Die.
Great title.
Thanks. Something my dad used to say all the time, and he would crack himself up telling us this. I'm not sure where he got it from. So when I was able to present him the book with his words on the cover, that was quite a thrill for both of us.
And then your novel, you wrote that next, your first novel?
Yeah, I wrote When the World Was Young after that, because publishers weren't really interested in publishing short stories. And so it took quite a while to find an agent for that. But once I did, she was able to find a publisher within a matter of weeks.
It's a good story. So your book is a lovely tribute to those who lost their lives in the Our Lady of Angels fire of 1958. Why did you choose that particular tragedy?
It's a story I was very familiar with because my mother-in-law was a student there. She had just graduated a few earlier before the fire, but her brother was an eighth grader at the time. And so she would always reminisce. Reminisce is not the right word. You could see the unresolved grief in her voice, and it was always hard to talk about. But the story she always told was how her brother was excused about 10 or 15 minutes before the fire because they needed some volunteers to help load a clothing truck. And he found out that day that 26 of his classmates had died. And when I talked to young people about this, I asked them, how many times do you think Uncle Jerry talked about this? And they genuinely don't know the answer, because if it were to happen today, there would be counselors in there immediately. But there was probably not a single time that he talked about it with anyone.
So you never got to talk to him about it?
No, I didn't. He died as a young man. He died when he was about 40. I know I would have talked to him now about it if he had lived longer. But even if I had tried back then, I don't think he would have been open to it. He would have shrugged it off. He would have changed the subject.
What a trauma for a kid. 13-year-old kid.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the fire. Why wasn't it put out sooner? Why didn't more students escape? Where were the fire trucks? What was happening?
Well, there was a fire station that was only a few blocks away, and the school didn't have any kind of efficient alarm system. You had to go outside the school to actually sound the alarm. And when that finally happened, the fire had been blazing for a while. There were no fire doors on the second floor, which is why many of the students who died were on the second floor. There was no sprinkler system, and the fire served to change all of that, not only in Chicago, but throughout the country. And one other final mishap, or really unfortunate tragedy, is that the firemen were given the wrong address, so they went to the rectory instead of the actual school, and so that took up quite a bit of time, necessary time.
So there were probably lots of other peripheral people who were traumatized, aside from the families. Mental illness. There's a lot of focus on that because Anthony has a mental illness. Can you talk about it and the treatment for it and how it came about for him?
Yeah, he has this condition. Nowadays, it's called a body integrity disorder, but back in 1967, it was not labeled as such. And my editor at Allium, she was able to find that out for me, which was fortunate, so I didn't mistakenly put that in there. But he feels that a part of his body, and particularly his leg, is not a part of him, and he feels like he needs to resolve it. So if you've ever had a situation where a tooth is cracked just a bit, your tongue is constantly going to that crack in the tooth, and you want to resolve it. So imagine that an entire body part didn't feel like a part of you, the lengths you would go to try to resolve that. There's not really what you would call a cure, but there's this one doctor, Dr. Ramachandran, who's become an expert in these sort of odd disorders, and he comes up with these ingenious, low-tech, graceful ways of solving these issues. And I don't want to get into it too specifically to ruin some of the surprises in the book.
Right. So was Anthony based on an actual student at the school?
No, I didn't want to appropriate that. He's not based on any particular person. I guess there's a part of me in all my characters, but no, he's not a student. He's not an actual student from the school, no.
Okay. He's a really interesting character. And he has a best friend, Marianne, who was in the same class as his sister. Can you talk about Marianne and a little bit about how did those who survived make it out? These were children. How'd they get out?
Yeah, that's still a puzzle because I'm not sure if they really did make it out emotionally. Like I said, my uncle never mm-hmm. talked about it. At one of my readings, I ran into a woman and she pointed out, she showed me a photograph, this iconic photograph from the Tribune with the firemen on the cover of on the front page. And she pointed to one of the firemen and said, "That's my father," pointed to a fireman. And I said, "Well, did he ever talk about it with you?" And she said, "No, not ever." So Marianne is the kind of character who forms this bond with Anthony because at least the two of them can talk about it and can talk about the fact that no one will reveal anything to them. No one will want to even broach the subject. So she tries to be as kind as she can because she knows that Anthony is suffering from this condition. And the central question becomes, what's the best way to help another person? And I'm not sure if what she does is the best solution, but it's the best solution that she can come up with, at least.
They're at the point that the story starts, they're both 20 years old. So Marianne seems way healthier than Anthony, is she?
Well, she appears that way, but she ends up having some problems of her own. And unlike Anthony, Marianne is able to support him, but there's really no one to support her as well. So she's probably one of the more lonely characters in the book, I guess you would say.
Yeah. There were a lot of lonely characters in the book, so we're going to talk about everybody. How about, can you discuss Anthony's relationship with his grandmother?
Yeah, Nona is one of these professional mourners. You probably have seen them who wear black for months and years, independent. No one's going to take advantage of her. Just really tough. And she'll do anything to protect her family. I just happened to see this program that Phil Rosenthal has on Netflix. I think it's called Feed Phil, where he goes to these different restaurants. And he visits New York and he interviews this 180-plus-year-old guy who makes pizzas. And he takes these pizzas out with his bare hands. And that pretty much sums up Nona, just tough, and no one's gonna mess with her.
So, did you have a Nona? Is she based on your Nona?
No, like I said, I came here when I was a year, so I didn't really know my grandparents. I visited them a few times, but there were Nonas in the neighborhood where I grew up in, and I guess my mom would be the closest one I can come to because she was famous for taking things out of the oven with no oven mitts.
Yeah, shocking. Wow. So what about Anthony's work and his relationship with Freddie, his boss?
Yeah, Freddie, he's one of my favorite characters. He's this old school Chicago guy who works for Streets and Sanitation, and he mangles the language, you know, give me three of those and two of these. And so I always think I grew up speaking three languages: English, Italian, and Chicago.
And can you talk a little more in Chicagoese?
Take three of them potatoes over there, not them over there. Yeah, yeah. I want the fresher ones over there, and the ones at the front.
Okay. It don't matter.
It don't matter. He's so unlike me, outgoing and funny and comfortable with himself, and I guess that's the reason I like him so much. And he's one of the few adults in Anthony's world that provides any kind of encouragement. So I guess a father figure of sorts.
Mm-hmm. And what about Anthony's work? What about the work that the two of them do?
Yeah, they don't do a whole lot of work. I think workers in Chicago used to be able to get away with that. You know, the famous image was four guys circling a sewer and one of the guys is working and the other three or four are just kind of looking around waiting. So, Freddie and Anthony don't do a whole lot of what you would call work. Freddie ends up in bars most often, but he provides the emotional support and he is able to pull some strings for Anthony to find out some things that he needs to find out.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the bars that they spend some time in.
Yeah, I did a little research on that. A lot of the bars were like Mike Royko hangouts because at one point they meet Mike Royko. And I just wanted to recreate the dark taverns of 1967 and the smells. And I don't know if I did it justice or not because I didn't spend a whole lot of time in bars.
You know, this is a national podcast, so there are going to be people who don't really know Mike Royko. Can you talk about him a little? Just explain who he was.
Yeah, he was this local columnist, journalist, and most politicians hated him, especially Mayor Daley. And Sox fans hated him. Gun enthusiasts hated him. But he gave voice to these little people who didn't have a voice, and he pointed out hypocrisy, even in himself. And it's just funny as hell, just one damn good writer. This is a daily column, and so people would be reading his column on the bus and stores everywhere. And not all the columns hold up, but it's amazing that any of them hold up because this is just a daily column.
Mm-hmm. And there's a book about him. He's known here.
Yeah, several books, sure. Yeah.
So, okay, on another track, why does Anthony think his parents blame him?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any actual truth to that. I think it's just like if you're planning a surprise party for someone, you're convinced that they know about it. And so I think he's just overthinks it. And the fact is he doesn't even know the events of the fire because he ends up blacking out immediately after. And so he doesn't really come to terms with this until quite late in the book.
But he thinks his parents blamed him for his sister.
Yeah, again, I think it's something he's exaggerated in his own life because his father is more or less estranged for most of the book. And this is the kind of guy who doesn't really believe that he deserves any good that comes to him. And so he's not able to be a father to his son.
So let's talk about the neighbor. Really interesting character. Another Chicago kind of portrait. Why is Lipschultz so obsessed with the fire and with Anthony?
Yeah, he's not as admirable as the other Chicago guy, Freddie. And I don't know if I was conscious while writing this book, but as I look back, I think he represents for me these school administrators who lose sight of what's important. One year we had we had administrators ban Halloween costumes at our school, and there were some clever students who were, I think they wore suits, and they could be costumes or maybe not. And so this one administrator ended up chasing a student around the halls like no one was going to show him up. And I think that mentality, I've lived with many administrators. I've worked at different schools, and so I've seen that so often that I'm pretty sure that I modeled Lipschultz after that kind of character. He's not going to put up with any insubordination. But to be more specific, since he's an ex-cop, I think he's still trying to solve the case. I think maybe he'll see some glory in it if he can solve this case. This is unfinished business. And since Anthony doesn't give him the respect that he thinks is his due, he is constantly mulling this over.
Yeah, and Chicago cops are kind of not getting a lot of great press right now, so it's kind of interesting to read something back then where kind of deserved the bad press. He's not a good guy.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to paint a broad brush here. I was just this one particular cop who was, not a great guy. And I don't know many cops. So I didn't base it on any particular cop. Like I said, more with administrators.
Mm-hmm. So how is the community around him involved in Anthony's quest for answers? Who's helping him? Who's blocking him? What about the nuns? What about the administrators that you've been talking about? Where's Anthony?
Yeah, it's a close-knit neighborhood, the kind of neighborhood where people have gardens in their backyard and they're making their own spaghetti sauce. But when it came to the fire, there wasn't, again, a lot of support. You were pretty much on your own. I remember reading of that some of these kids were still wearing the same coats years later, and you could still smell the fire in these coats. And you know, why the hell no one thought of starting some fundraiser for these kids to get new coats is just incredible.
Devastating commentary on the community, or well, on the city too.
Yeah, I'm sure if they had addressed it more directly, and if they had come to terms with the emotional toll, that those kinds of things might have been addressed. But it was this culture of the late 50s. It was a Catholic culture. It was the Italian culture. You just didn't deal with these issues head on.
But then what did they do? What came, what happened afterwards? How did the city change? You said there were changes to fire laws. What happened in the city?
Well, the fire departments had already had some codes in place, but they didn't really enforce them. The archdiocese was able to put them off and nothing's going to happen. We're going to be okay. But afterward, there were sprinklers that you had to have, and fire doors that we talked about a little bit earlier, and more efficient alarm systems.
But you said there were rules in place, but they just avoided them or didn't pay attention. So how do we address that? What happens now if a school, what happens now?
Well, 92 children died, so I think that woke people up, and they knew they couldn't put this off anymore, and they had to enforce it.
Well, was anybody punished? Anybody slapped on the wrist?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
No culpability.
I'm pretty sure that nothing like that happened.
Oh. So what should we take away from Where My Body Ends and the World Begins?
Well, to me, reading is so personal that I don't know what readers will take away. But just like when you listen to a good song, I would hope that you would make it your own, or you watch a movie and there's this illusion that the movie was made for you. This famous neurologist, Oliver Sacks, he had in his last book, which came out after he died, he said something that has stuck with me. He says that when we think of a memory, like our father was trying to change the tire or something like that, was it really a memory, or was it a story that we heard, or was it an article that we read where it wasn't even our dad? We're not quite sure. So we're not really good at pointing out the source of a memory. But he says this indifference to source allows us to take in books and movies and art almost as if they're primary experiences, as if they're coming from within us, which is just a beautiful way of looking at it, I think. So all in all, I think I would hope that people read it carefully and make it their own, and hopefully reminds them of something in their lives that they need to be reminded of.
I forgot to ask, so does this book have any connection with your previous, with any of your short stories, or with anything from your first novel? Is there any connection?
I guess with my first two books, they focus more on the Italian-American experience. And even though this main character is an Italian-American, I think that doesn't come to the foreground as much. I guess all of them focus on families and how we deal with the dynamics within a family, and how tragedy shapes family life and how we endure.
Hmm. So what are you working on now?
Well, I wrote a screenplay of the book, the first draft, and I need to get back to that. And that's an interesting, fun process because you have to make it about 100 pages. So you have to fuse characters, get rid of characters. You have to make sure that the action sends the message. You can't have too much exposition. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on that, and finishing up also a mystery set in Chicago. It's there's a 17-year-old boy who's in jail, accused of murdering his father, and his younger brother is scouring the city trying to find clues to get him out of jail. And then I'm writing songs. I'm taking classes at Old Town School of Folk Music, and that's pretty satisfying because you can finish a song in a few days, a week, 2 weeks, as opposed to a book that takes several years.
Did you want to sing something for us?
Maybe not.
So if in the movie version, the director said, Tony, we want you to be in the movie, who would you like to be? Freddie or Lipschultz? Or do you think you could get away with playing 20-year-old Anthony?
No, I think I'd be just an extra walking by like okay. Alfred Hitchcock or something like that. I don't think I'd want to be cast. But it is fun thinking about other actors being cast. I haven't really thought specifically about that. But
okay, let us know. And so are you about to publish anything? Is something coming out soon? Because this came out last year in 2017?
Yeah, at the end of the year, in December of 2017. Nothing in the works, but I have a few things out there to one publisher and maybe some agents. So,
okay, so you're getting ready. So we should all look out for you.
It's a slow process.
Right?
It is.
But worthwhile.
It is.
I loved reading your book. I think I told you I read it in a day, in an afternoon. I couldn't put it down.
That's what every writer wants to hear.
Right? So thank you so much for sharing your time, Tony Romano.
Oh, thank you.
It has been a pleasure. Hope to
Thanks.
Hear from you soon.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
And thank you for listening to this podcast from the New Books Network. Once again, I'm G.P. Gottlieb, host of New Books in Fiction, and today I've been talking with Tony Romano about his book Where My Body Ends and the World Begins, published by Allian Press in December 2017. Goodbye until my next podcast, and may all your reading be delicious, engaging, and inspiring. Mm-hmm.